Proceed on that matter.
May it please the court, I'm Sarah Robsky on behalf of Mr. Daley, also his number of family members here as well. I would like to reserve 2 minutes. We're asking this court to reverse Mr. Daley's conviction on count one against John Doe for failure to identify in any way, shape, or form unintended victim in this case. We're also asking the court to reverse his convictions against the detectives on the grounds that there was insufficient evidence that he was actually the person shooting at the officers. But as to count one, Mr. Daley committed reckless endangerment. He did not commit assault in the first degree. Assault in the first degree is a specific intent crime with the specific intent to cause great bodily harm to another. And in Elmai, they define specific intent as the intent to produce a specific result, as opposed to the intent to do the physical act that produces the result.
You don't think you can infer intent from pointing a gun at someone and pulling the trigger?
No, Your Honor. I mean, that to me is, you have to have an intended victim. You wouldn't have the concept of transferred intent if you didn't have an intent to shoot somebody or harm somebody. It's a very specific intent crime. And the fact that he shot a gun, that's reckless endangerment. It's like a drive-by shooting without the car.
But the officer's testimony, as I understood it, was that he actually shot at some particular individuals.
That's
even
not
though
what,
they were unnamed and undescribed.
They shot in the direction. The court found that he shot into the crowd. The state argues that that includes the group of people who he was having the verbal altercation with, but that's not what the court found. He found shot into the crowd. There were 100-some people, patrons outside of the club, and that John Doe merely stands in as a representative sense for one of those patrons. Did not make any reference to the group of people with whom he was having the verbal altercation. And if indeed he was that close to them, presumably, and intended to shoot, actually hit one of those people, presumably he would have certainly been able to because he got several shots off. I'm just saying, it wasn't in the findings, and I would disagree that automatically gives rise to the quantum of proof you need on this. And again, as to transferred intent, the state cites to Elmai and Wilson, both of whom had a very specifically identified victim. And as the Wilson court said, intent against one is intent against all, but you need to have intent against one, and you simply don't have that here. Nor did they charge him with shooting an unintended victim. Ironically, in the JNS, it does say that he can't have contact with the one person who did receive a gunshot wound, even though he wasn't charged with actually shooting that person. The state also relies on the California case of People versus Griggs, which is factually similar. But it's a very it's a general intent statute, and as the Griggs court said, the assault statute is seeking to punish the reckless disregard of human life. And that's exactly what we have here, but we have it codified under a separate statute, the reckless endangerment statute. And I do include several arguments that are policy about why you need to have an identified victim in this case. If this had been to a jury, you would have had a unanimity. It would have been impossible to have a unanimous verdict under these circumstances. And double jeopardy down the road, where if this judge had found Mr. Daley not guilty of assault in the first degree, the state could have come back, filed the exact same information, presented the exact same evidence, and just said, oh, well, this is a different John Doe. And that is not what the assault in the first degree statute stands for.
Isn't that the only way that transferred intent really plays a role in this case? I mean, that's why double jeopardy could not apply. If he intended to shoot one of the three persons or four persons that were he was in an argument with, that intent is the intent that would have been transferred to the remaining members of the crowd, is it not?
But we don't know who. There was no identification. I understand you, but you have to have intent to assault one, and we don't have any of that here. We have John Doe. The cases that I was able to find that outside of the jurisdiction where the victim is not named, there is very, very specific descriptions, physical description. One of the cases, the assault was caught on video, so you have an actual picture of the victim. Another one, it was someone who was known to the defendant. He didn't know the person's name, but he knew exactly who he was, even though he couldn't name him. But he could describe him. And we have none of that. We don't even have, you know, oh, he was shooting at somebody wearing, you know, a white shirt or, you know, tennis shoes. We don't have anything to be able to determine who he was intending to assault, much less to transfer that to somebody else. So, is there any other questions? Okay, thank you.
You'll reserve the rest of your time.
Yes,
gives
please.
You 5 minutes.
May it please the court, Jacob Brown for respondent, State of Washington. We ask this court to affirm Daley's conviction for assault in the first degree against John Doe as charged in count one, and for as charged against three Seattle Police Department officers as charged in counts two through four. With respect to count one, the fundamental question before the court this morning is it first degree assault when a person who obviously intends to inflict great bodily harm levels a handgun and fires it at a group of people standing 10 feet away who flee in obvious apprehension of harm and are never identified? Is that first degree assault, or is that merely the gross misdemeanor of reckless endangerment? For very sound public policy reasons, for sound legal reasons, and in order to fulfill the intent of the legislature, this court should hold that those facts do indeed give rise to assault in the first degree.
Did the trial court hold that that Mr. Daley intended to inflict great bodily harm upon a specific person or group of persons?
Your Honor, the trial court certainly made legal findings establishing the various elements of first degree assault. If Your Honor will give me one moment, I have the actual order right here. These are the findings of facts and conclusions of law. Here the court found, in finding of fact 11, which could be construed more as a legal conclusion but was framed as a finding of fact, that when Daley fired his handgun at the unidentified people, the defendant, with the intent to inflict great bodily harm, did assault one or more of them, and John Doe is a stand-in. The trial court made the same findings in number 12, that Daley intended to inflict great bodily harm on the three Seattle police officers. I mentioned earlier that there were public policy reasons as well as sound legal reasons for this ruling. To briefly address policy, the problem with appellant's position is that if this is not first-degree assault, then the more egregious or more frightening an assailant is, the more likely people are to flee and to not come forward, the more likely that person is to entirely escape accountability for what is should be a rather serious violent felony.
But if you were right, why would we have a crime of reckless endangerment? Every discharge of a firearm at a group of unidentified individuals would be first-degree assault.
The distinction between those scenarios, Your Honor, is that here the evidence established by inference and by, I think, direct evidence by the officer's observations that Daley did indeed intend the specific intent of inflicting great bodily harm.
But that's because he discharged a firearm.
It's because he discharged it while leveling his hand directly at a group of people that he had been arguing with that were standing 10 feet away from him. The officers watched him walk across the street in a verbal altercation with 3 to 5 men. They watched him, you know, exchange excited, agitated gestures and yelling. They watched him pull a gun out of his waistband, point it directly at them, and from 10 feet away fire multiple shots. So I think under that circumstance, that certainly gives rise to the reasonable inference that he intended to inflict great bodily harm. And by the way, I completely disagree with appellant's contention that you cannot infer intent from actions, as Your Honor asked. Wilson provides on 125 Washington 2nd and 217 that specific intent can be inferred from the circumstances surrounding an assault. So while the specific intent to great bodily harm is usually, those are the court's words, usually established by proving that a defendant intended to inflict great bodily harm on a specific person, it necessarily follows that it is not always established by proof that they intended to inflict great bodily harm on a specific person. Instead, you can infer it from the circumstances of the assault itself. So that's moving on to the legal reasons for the holding that the state is urging this court to make today. The other key legal principle is that under Washington's first-degree assault statute, the intent to inflict great bodily harm does not need to match any specific victim. And that follows from Elmy and from Wilson. It requires specific intent, but that specific intent expressly is only the intent to inflict great bodily harm. It does not match a specific individual. And then the final principle, as provided by the Plano case, which will be 67 Washington Appellate Reporter at 679-80, is that the name of a victim is simply not the element of assault. If it required a specific victim, you would think courts would either hold that a name was required or at least have pronounced more specifically on victim specificity. But courts have held in situations that the specific intent need not match a specific person and that intent can be inferred.
But didn't we end up with a drive-by shooting statute because where you couldn't identify the person to be assaulted, it wasn't first-degree assault?
I think in that situation, the legislature was recognizing that that scenario tends to arise in cases involving drive-bys. I think you need to have a drive-by in order for that statute to be triggered.
You could have a run-by and have the same result. The question was you didn't know the victim's identity. They weren't necessarily struck. Sometimes they were. But the issue was intent.
It may fall under the drive-by statute. I have to admit, Your Honor, I didn't prepare any briefing on that issue. It wasn't raised by the parties. Even if it did fall under drive-by also, that's, of course, no reason to conclude that it's not also first-degree assault, where the elements of first-degree assault are simply that the person intends to inflict great bodily harm and they assault another with a firearm. Under the elements of the statute and the case law I've just cited, it falls squarely within those elements and those principles that this is first-degree assault in this case. Now, appellant has posited that this case should be judged in light of a case, I think, from Maryland, State v. Edmonds, and also a case from Florida, State v. Conroy. Those cases involved an assault on a specific person who was known in all respects except for their name. That's not the scenario of this case. The scenario of this case is that someone fires at a group of people and everyone flees. That's the precise fact pattern of State v. Griggs, the California case. I know there's been a contention that California allows recklessness. If you actually examine Griggs, though, where the court talks about recklessness and then follow the case cited there, the only reason recklessness is mentioned in the context of that case is because California law allows a fact finder to presume the intent to commit battery from the conscious disregard for human life. So it's not that simply reckless conduct is sufficient to on its own establish the element of the intent to commit battery in California. It's that you can infer or even presume in California the intent to commit battery from reckless conduct. That's not meaningfully different from in Washington under Wilson, where you can infer the specific intent to cause great bodily harm by the circumstances surrounding someone's actions. And indeed, as the court provided in Griggs, and this is 216 California Appellate 3rd at 742, and I think this bears quoting at length, to understand what constitutes the person of another, in other words, a victim, for our purposes, which would be assault with a deadly weapon in California, we focus on the actions of the defendant. The victim's fear, lack of fear, injury, or lack of injury are not elements which need to be proved or disproved. All that is necessary is that there is a victim. The characteristics of the victim are not critical elements of the offense. And in Washington, while it's true that you can prove an assault, by the victim's lack of fear, or injury, or lack of injury, that would be two of the three common law definitions of assault, which are actual battery, attempted battery, and apprehension of harm. You can also prove it simply by attempted battery. And in this case, I think the evidence established amply for a reasonable fact finder to find that Daly attempted battery when he shot at a group of people standing 10 feet away from him, and when he then shot at three Seattle police detectives. So I think that the reasoning of Griggs is compelling and sound, and I think this court should endorse that reasoning in finding that the evidence was sufficient to establish assault in the first degree in this case. With my remaining minute, I'd like to briefly address the remaining counts. It is a much more straightforward application of the sufficiency standard for counts 2 through 4. It's just whether a reasonable fact finder could find that the elements of the crime were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, taking the state's evidence as true and construed in the light most favorable to the state. Frankly, I do believe the video shows these assaults. I've attached detailed appendices that I know have been the subject of some litigation. I think the court can resolve that as it sees fit. Frankly, though, the security footage ultimately is almost extraneous in this case. The officers testified that one camera shows a muzzle flash at the exact moment that another camera shows Daly in that location. And in that same moment, one of the officers felt bullets going right by his head. And the other officer, I believe, saw Daly turn and point the gun in his direction. Those were the two officers standing right by each other. And then the last officer, as he was charging up the ramp, saw later on the security footage, the muzzle flash, right in that moment in that location. Thank you.